Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of October. Beginning yesterday, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services began a redesigned naturalization test. All applicants who file for naturalization from now on will be required to take this redesigned test. Civics, history, and government items from the redesigned natural test are what we're going to be talking about. Some of the items have more than one possible answer listed, and it's 100 questions here. I think that the applicants only have to answer 10. I don't know how it's figured out here. We thought it'd be interesting to do a program on this, the kinds of questions that are asked. Who designed these questions? Is it important to know the answers to these questions for American government knowledge and to become a citizen of the United States? What would you put on this? And how difficult is it to become a citizen? We'll talk about all of that this hour of the program. These are some of the questions on the redesigned test, just so you get an idea of how easy it is or how difficult it may be. The first part is Principles of American Democracy. What is the supreme law of the land? What does the Constitution do? The idea of self-government is in the first three words of the Constitution. What are these words? What is an amendment? What do we call the first 10 amendments to the Constitution? What is one right or freedom from the First Amendment? How many amendments does the Constitution have? That's a tricky one. A lot of people don't get that. What did the Declaration of Independence do? What are two rights in the Declaration of Independence? Just to give you a sampling, we'll give you more of the questions as the hour goes on here. We have with us Professor Kevin Johnson, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, and he is also a professor of public interest law and Chicana studies at the University of California, Davis School of Law. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line, 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send us an email, that'd be great. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm particularly interested. I'm sure there are some of you listening who have been through the naturalization process and the test. It would obviously have been the old test because the new test just started yesterday. So call and let us know about that process. Professor Johnson, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Tell me about this process of coming up with this list of questions. Who decides what's important to know about American democracy?
Well, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services is in charge with putting together the test and coming up with rules and procedures for naturalization as directed by Congress. And Citizenship and Immigration Services actually appears to have done a fairly thorough job in consulting with different groups, different school districts, different organizations to try to identify some issues with the past test and to come up with good questions for the current test. And there are a number of issues that come up, including what you want to test, and how you ask the questions, because some of the questions took some massaging to make sure that they were clear, especially for many people who are who have learned English as a second language. So I think that there's been a fairly extensive consultation with different groups, including the LA School District, the National Council for La Raza, the National Academy for Sciences, the Manhattan Institute, and efforts were made to have community meetings and focus groups, and I think a good faith effort was put forward to try to figure out what do we want to test, how do we want to test it, and how is this going to work.
Right. And there are 100 questions, but my understanding is the applicants are given 10 and you have to get 6 right or 7 right. How does that work?
I think you have it pretty much right. There's interview officers who, you know, ask these questions, and there are a number of different right answers. If you look at the Citizenship Immigration Services website, they have the tests, and they also have some possible answers, because sometimes it's not just one answer to a question. For example, question number 6 is, what one right or freedom is there in the First Amendment? And there's a bunch, as we all know. And so the applicant, the petitioner for naturalization, just has to answer one of those. But it's, you know, there's an interview, a naturalization interview, and a test, and it's it's a stressful situation. And some of these questions, I mean, as I said, I think there was a good faith effort to direct, to identify the questions and to model the questions. But some of these would be hard to answer by natural-born U.S. citizens.
Right. But you have a chance to study these questions, right, before you take the test?
Yes, you have a chance. And I think there are flashcards. There's a guide that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services puts out. I mean, you were able to prepare for this test.
Mm-hmm. Why did they decide to change the questions here? Was there something wrong with the old test?
Well, I don't know if there was something wrong, but there's always room for improvement. Mm. And there were some questions that had to be clarified. I think that Citizenship and Immigration Services wanted to focus a little bit more on the rights and responsibilities of citizens. And you get a sense of that from looking at the questions, the government questions, the civics questions. There are some new questions that deal basically with geography. It's called the Integrated Civics Section, and it has some questions that really are necessary if you want to understand some basics of U.S. history, like, name one of the two longest rivers in the United States.
Oh.
And if you don't understand about the Mississippi, it's hard to understand, the purchase of a good part of the United States from France in the early 1800s. So I think name one U.S. territory. And I think there was an effort to, expand a bit on the kinds of things tested and be a little more focused in places.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting that this test was administered to people I know in Chicago and outside some library, thinking in various parts of the country, and people who have been citizens for a long period of time. Some of them are obvious questions, but some of them they just went, "Ooh, you should know this, but I don't know this."
Some of them, I think that's exactly right. How many amendments does the Constitution have? And I think my guess would be that probably a majority of Americans don't know that. I didn't know that before I looked. And actually, it could even be a disputed question because one amendment was repealed. And does that count as one of the amendments? I don't know. I don't think there are many trick questions there. I just think some of them are hard questions.
Right. I like the one. What is one thing Benjamin Franklin is famous for?
Yep.
Yeah.
I thought about the flying the kite.
Right. Right. That's what people think, right?
I don't think that's one of the answers.
No, it's not. It's not. I think about libraries, though, when I think about Franklin, too.
And that is one
of the answers. But he did so many things. You could have, 15 possibilities.
Yeah. One of the things I really liked on some of the questions, I have to say, is, there's a question about, name one American Indian tribe.
Yes.
What did Martin Luther King Jr. do? I think, this shows, there's a question about slavery of African Americans. And I think, these aren't sort of specific questions. They're more thematic parts of American history. And I think that it was a good idea to try to give people from other countries a sense of what we are as a nation, historically, racially, and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is information that would be good for all of us to know. I would assume that if you go through the American educational system, by the end of grade 12, would it be, you would know the answers to these questions?
You'd hope so. You'd sure hope so. I mean, I was thinking, gosh, what tribes would I identify? And I'm sure I could come up with some names, but they wouldn't be on the tip of my tongue.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you don't live in Wisconsin.
That's true.
Right. We have a lot of names that a lot of tribes in a lot of places are named in because of the tribes. So let's go to phone calls, and we'll do that in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Kevin Johnson is our guest, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at the University of California, Davis School of Law. We're looking at this new naturalization test, which just went into effect yesterday. History and government items from the redesigned naturalization test. There are 100 questions, and you could apply for citizenship get any 10 of these, and then you have to answer, I believe, 7 of them correctly. We've given you an idea of, but some of them were pretty interesting questions. Who signs bills to become laws? Who vetoes bills? What are 2 cabinet-level positions? What does the judicial branch do? Who's the Chief Justice of the United States? Who is the governor of your state? What is the capital of your state? Rights and responsibilities section. There are 4 amendments to the Constitution about who can vote. Describe one of them. What are 2 rights for only for United States citizens? What are 2 rights of everyone living in the United States? What is 1 promise you make when you become a United States citizen? And they're kind of interesting, right? If you want to take the test, you can go to the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services website. It's USCIS.gov. Take the test over dinner tonight. That's what we'll do at my house. And see how you fare. And some of you have taken this, I'm sure, gone through the process of naturalization, so we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Or if you would like to send us an email, the email address is talk@wpr.org. Tammy from Menasha is our first caller, Professor. Hi, Tammy.
Hi there. Good morning.
Hi.
I just have a comment, and it's kind of funny that its subject is up right now. I have a middle schooler who's in 8th grade and studying American history, and I hear her comments that I made at her age right now. This is boring. Why do we have to study this? Blah, blah, blah. And I just think that, yes, we have this in school, and I don't know how many kids really appreciate our history until now that I'm older, and I wish I had paid more attention.
Professor Johnson.
Well, I have three teenagers, and they have similar reactions to U.S. history, except for my son likes to study military conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the benefits of a test like this is to be able to convey some of that basic knowledge about American history to people who are also very motivated to, you know, absorb it and learn it. And one of the interesting things to me is how so many immigrants to this country, more so than U.S. citizens, value the political and other freedoms that you have in this country. Many came from countries where there wasn't the kind of freedom that we have here, and one of the reasons they came, for some, is, you know, to have that freedom. So I think my sense is that immigrants are more interested in this than many U.S. citizens in studying history and studying civics, and it's quite amazing in some ways.
Mm-hmm. It's such a I don't know why it is that we're losing interest in this, because it's a fascinating subject, isn't it? I mean, it's all around us. Now we're in a presidential race, and so you would think that we would just gravitate toward it. They're fascinating stories. I don't know why it is that we don't. That we don't love this. That her middle school student doesn't just love history.
Well, some kids do, but I think a majority don't. One of the issues is how does it relate to what's going on today? How does it relate to, you know, video games and iPods and all the other stuff that are, you know, much more teen friendly? But I think it's one of those things that. Certainly, Americans come around to, you know, as they mature, maybe not so much in the early ages.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Tammy.
Go ahead. I'd say one of the things we've been stressing to her is this is important to her because we are American Indian heritage. We're half Comanche.
Mm.
And, you know, this is our culture, you know, and I've been stressing and I've been getting more involved, too, with trying to follow through with what they're learning in class as well. So I'm learning again. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. 800-486-8655 is our number. Well, we've also had, and I wonder if this is a result of what's happened in the last few years with our educational system. It seems as though most of the resources, the amazing amount of testing that's going on in this country is devoted to reading and to math. Not that those aren't very important subjects, but what about history?
Well, I mean, that's I think part of what you say is right, and I certainly see at the university level where universities often are really searching for grant and other monies to fund all kinds of things, including education. And there's a lot more money in the sciences and engineering than there are in the humanities and social sciences. So that tends to have a trickle-down effect, and it's unfortunate,
mm-hmm.
But I do think it has an impact.
Yeah. What happens if, first of all, how do they mix up these questions? You don't know what 10 you're going to get. Do they take a certain number from each category?
Well, they try to balance it out, but there's a fair amount of discretion in the interview officer, the person who's conducting the interview. And there's some judgment calls you'd have to imagine in the answers you give, just how close they are, because they're, some things are pretty clear, like how old do you have to be to vote, but other things are less clear, like, name one important thing that Abraham Lincoln did. I would think that the suspension of habeas corpus was an important thing, even though I might not like it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not among the items on the list.
And, mm-hmm.
But there's some judgment calls that have to be made. And I think that, the overall purpose of the test is part of an overall interview to figure out whether you've satisfied the various requirements. There's a moral character requirement for naturalization. There's an attached, basic requirement that you be attached to constitutional principles. And there's a requirement that you can have basic understanding of English and have a basic understanding of history and civics. So I think that there's some, not every interview is the same, and there are different questions asked to different people, because they can't ask everybody 100 questions.
Right.
Because it would just be too long, and you can't really give a standardized test. It doesn't really seem to work when you have some discretion in the answering. The best thing that can be done is sort of a sampling of questions.
Yeah. And what happens if you only get 4 right? Can you take the test again in so many days? Do you know?
Well, you have to take it again. You have to go, back to the interview.
Mm.
But you can appeal, but that's not going to do you much good. It's more likely you're going to have to take the test again after a certain amount of time. And there are lines for these interviews in certain offices, so it can take some time.
Mm.
One of the things that's happening right now is that more people are applying to naturalize for all kinds of reasons. But there's been a sort of an increase from about 450,000 naturalization petitions in 2004 to about a little over 700,000 last year. And that's put a strain on Citizenship and Immigration mm-hmm. Services. And one of the strains is you got longer lines for interviews.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the reasons of more people wanting to naturalize?
Well, there's a number of them. One of the more recent ones is that the fees went up to $675 for each naturalization.
Really?
They went up July 30th was the last day. The old
$675. That's a lot of money.
Yes, it is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Poor people or working people or middle income people.
Sure.
It's a fair amount of money. If you got a husband and wife, then you double that. But the fees just went up. There's also an increasing concern in some immigrant communities about immigration reform, deportation campaigns, a desire to participate in the political process given the debates over immigration reform. One of the things we saw in California in 1994 after the passage of an immigration initiative, Proposition 187, we saw an increase in immigrant filing naturalization petitions because they felt that they had been sort of maligned in the political process and wanted to participate in that process, and also feared, at the most basic level, deportation and possible loss of benefits. And so I think we're seeing a repeat of that with a very fiery debate over immigration reform in 2006 and earlier this year, and with the sort of the politicization of immigrant communities in the spring 2006 marches. There's a lot of people who are saying, I want to become a formal part of the political process, I want to naturalize, and I want some protection from deportation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are some of the basic reasons
right.
for increases in naturalization.
Thanks very much for the call, Tammy. We'll take more calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if anybody wants to take part of the test, we don't have time for all of the questions, but let me just look here at the categories. We can have you take, you get about 12 or 10 questions in the category. If you want to pick your category, Principles of American Democracy is one. System of Government is another. And that one's a pretty, oh, that's real lengthy. Rights and Responsibilities is another. American History, you want to take a few quiz questions in American History? Those are interesting. Integrated Civics, which looks at geography. And so, you know, take your pick. If you want, I'm not putting any pressure on you. You don't have to take the test. But if you want to, well, you could. And show everybody how smart you are. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Kevin Johnson, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano-Chicana Studies at the University of California Davis School of Law, is our guest. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050. Professor Kevin Johnson is our guest, and we go to Roger from Beaver Dam next. Hello, Roger.
Good morning. Referring to the education in terms of understanding history and young people, domestic young people's lack of interest in history, I agree with you, Kathleen, that there are many interesting, compelling stories, historical stories, but I will challenge you to try and find one in a middle school or high school history textbook. The way these stories are presented are neither compelling nor interesting, and that is one of the reasons why young people find it so difficult to become interested in history until they reach advanced education. One of the other reasons, I think, too, is because we don't teach geography anymore, and history and geography are so interrelated in terms of the land masses and where people are located and what their occupations are and what they do and how that relates to history in an area. And that really is an area that the social sciences have neglected since the early 80s.
Professor Johnson.
No, I think there's some truth to that, and I think that actually, even the naturalization exam that does focus on geography is going in a direction that you probably think it should be going. It struck me, one of the things I have used actually getting my son interested in history is some historical novels. He loves the Jeffrey Shara book, Killer Angels, about the Little Round Top battle at Gettysburg. It was much more alive for him than the Gettysburg Address, for example, that he had to recite in one of his classes. I think that there may be some truth to that.
And yet, I don't know, maybe I'm just old, but I think there's something to be said, because I love Abraham Lincoln so much, there's something to be said for knowing the Gettysburg Address as well. I mean, there's something to be, those words are so gorgeous, they're so beautiful, his speeches were so beautiful, you can just say them aloud over and over. Maybe I'm just peculiar in this regard, but you can say them aloud over and over, they're meaningful.
Well, I mean, you could write an entire book. I mean, there has been an entire book, Gary Wills' book, about the Gettysburg Address, how it came about, what it meant, and how it fit into history. But I think some of, and I agree with you, actually, about the address, but some of the nuances of that are something that you're going to be more likely to, engage when you're in college, probably, than when you're in 7th, 8th grade.
So where do the people who are becoming citizens, they've got all these questions that they can get and study, but are there textbooks that are lively and wonderful that they can also get a little bit more in-depth knowledge of American history?
I think that there's more of an effort to focus on sort of the basic knowledge that's being tested here as opposed to the nuances and real interesting episodes of American history. I think that there are questions here where you're going to focus on the flashcard answers, because if you didn't, it'd be very difficult to know how to answer it. For example, question 2 says, what does the Constitution do? Now, a law professor could talk about that for hours on end. The answers that are, you know, listed on the Citizenship and Immigration Services sort of answer key is sort of set up the government, define the government, protect basic rights of Americans. I think that the test is really focused. Well, if you're taking the test, you got to focus on what answers are you looking for and how do I pass it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's
right.
More likely you're gonna learn that there are 27 amendments to the Constitution, which is the accepted answer, as opposed to the fact that one was repealed and there's a long history about prohibition and it didn't work, and which is an interesting history if you ask me. But it seems to me that there's you're going to focus on just giving the answers that are wanted as opposed
right.
to the nuanced version of
exactly.
facts.
I could just see you taking the test. You'd drive the person crazy, wouldn't you? Well, let me tell you about this and that. I don't know if you'd pass or not, huh?
No, I mean, question 11, what is the economic system of the United States? I probably would get that, capitalist economy or market economy. But that's a very complicated question.
Right.
Question, if you're an economist, to take a look at it, what is the rule of law? It seems to me that they're going to focus on sort of the accepted answers, and the flashcards help with that. There are classes that help that attorneys can provide guidance. There are books that you can look at, I've been somewhat critical of our immigration authorities. I read the frequently asked questions, the naturalization questions, and the fact that I was pretty impressed with the efforts to make this a doable test that's a real test, and to get the information out there to people. This is what we're testing.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Some people poked holes in some of the questions and suggested that there were some problems, but it seems to me that a good faith effort was made, and it's a real hard task to do, put this all together. And
sure it is.
They did a pretty good job, if you ask me.
Yeah, I am with you on that. Roger, is there a history book that you think would really wow young students and they'd want to forever become engaged in the study of history or not? Oh, Roger is gone. Let me ask you that question, Professor Johnson. He made reference to history textbooks in this country. I would imagine there are some terrific textbooks out there, aren't there?
Well, I think there are. I'm not that familiar with sort of middle and in secondary school textbooks, but I've noticed just a growing body of sort of historical novels, and if you really want to grab students into that, and also grab them into reading, because to me that's probably the most important part of the education process,
mm-hmm.
Just getting kids addicted to reading. I think that looking at books like that can really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Roger, very much for your call. Let us go next to Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have two questions. I'll tell you, I think the habeas corpus was mentioned in the Magna Carta, and I'm wondering, for me it means like a body of evidence, but I want to know what it means literally, and when was it applied figuratively?
And would this be one of the questions that you'd have to know on the test, Professor Johnson?
Well, it's certainly not a question you have to know on the test. I think your understanding that the habeas corpus derives from the Magna Carta is much more sophisticated than most law professors probably would know. I think habeas corpus basically means bring me the body. And it's a petition you file in a court where you want, in effect, to have the prisoner presented to the court or given to the court and then given to you. Today, for example, you file a habeas corpus petition in a court when you're trying to release an inmate who you allege has been wrongfully convicted of a crime or has been convicted of a crime in violation of the Constitution, denial of the right to counsel or a fair trial or something like that. So you're when you file one of those petitions, you're saying, federal court, please bring me this prisoner, bring me the body, and allow the person to be released. So that's basically what habeas corpus is about. And actually, sometimes in immigration cases, there are habeas corpus petitions filed when somebody is allegedly wrongfully detained. So that's what the petition means. It's not something, you know, that kind of nuance isn't something you'd be required to know for the naturalization test. And I don't remember specifically that it is mentioned in any of the questions.
Thanks, Mary, for the call. Melissa from Appleton is next. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I was wondering, given the amount of subjectivity of question choice as well as interpreting their answers, first of all, is there any concerns that have been raised about possible discrimination, like using it, like choosing the hardest questions because you don't think someone should become a citizen? And secondly, even if there's not discrimination going on, does it create problems for the appeal process that someone might claim they were discriminated against in that way?
I am not aware of, I mean, there are people who get their petitions denied, and sometimes they're not happy, and sometimes they file appeals. Usually, though, the problem is not with the questions or the test. The problem is with some other part of the naturalization petition process. For example, whether one of the things that you're required to do to be eligible for naturalization is to establish good moral character.
Hmm.
Suppose you have certain criminal convictions. Sometimes the question is that does that defeat your claim to good moral character? And there's some convictions, petty theft, a traffic ticket, clearly are not going to be based for denial. But possible basis for denial petition, something like a assault and battery, something like mm-hmm. that, more significant. So I think that's where you're more likely to get a petition denied. Now, in terms of the questions and the tests, one of the issues is, and it comes up, is you're required to have a basic ability to read and write and converse in English. And you're giving these tests, and sometimes it's hard to understand. You have to have a very good ear. And that seems to me often a bigger problem than the allegations of discrimination. And they don't come up very much. Once you've gone that way through the process, my experience has been the interview officers act in good faith, and it's not, I mean, I'm sure there may be bad apples, but they want this process to work.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me as though your understanding of English has to be pretty thorough in order to answer some of these questions, because they're not real easy.
No, unless you're just memorizing the rote, by rote.
I see.
And I think that to understand the question, you have to have some good understanding of English, like the idea of self-government is in the first three words of the Constitution. What are these words? That's pretty easy to read, but if your English isn't great and you're listening to that question,
mm-hmm.
it could pose some difficulties. And that's one of the reasons I think they sort of worked hard at making the questions pretty short, pretty declarative, pretty to the point, and ran them past a number of groups to make sure that people were comfortable with the way they're posed. But I think you're exactly right. Mm-hmm. You have to have a pretty good grasp of English to even understand the question, much less give an answer.
And some of the words are rather poetic. The we, the people, in order to form a more perfect union. There's something poetic about all of that. It's more than just the words, right?
Yeah, I think it's, and it tells you something about our nation and how we view ourselves as a people. That particular question is really trying to convey this, something, we the people, we as a nation,
mm-hmm.
Some national identity. And part of the entire naturalization process is designed to embrace people, bring them into us as a country, and assimilate them, integrate them into our country. And part of this entire test is to, get them to answer questions or be conversant with how we view ourselves in a nation that's going to be theirs.
Yes. Thank you, Melissa, for your call. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Or you can use that email if you want to. Maybe you don't want to, but if you want to, it's talk, talk at WPR.org. Julie is next. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Fine, how are you?
Really good.
Good.
I am so excited to have a chance to ask a couple of questions. My daughter-in-law is looking at taking the naturalization test. She's been in this country for 3 years, and we actually don't know how long she has to be here before she can take it.
It's usually 5 years as a lawful permanent resident with continuous residence during those 5 years.
And when you say lawful permanent resident, do you mean from the time she actually got her green card?
When she got her green card, she came here as a lawful permanent resident.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, you have to be here 5 years before
okay.
you can naturalize. And if she left the country briefly, there are some exceptions for brief absences, but it's one of those things you have to pay some attention to. The 5 years is pretty generous. It's been pretty consistent throughout United States history that we require 5 years of continuous permanent residence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the more generous among naturalization periods in the world.
Really?
It's quite generous. Well, our naturalization laws are relatively generous as far as they go. Some countries, including Germany, until relatively recently, didn't allow certain people, unless they could trace their ancestors to Germany.
Really?
To naturalize
wow.
and become.
Oh, my gosh.
That's one of the reasons there are so many Turkish immigrants who, for so long a period, could not become citizens. Germany has liberalized its naturalization laws, but the U.S. naturalization laws have been pretty liberal for a long time.
Now, I have one other question, too,
sure.
And this is really critical for us. My daughter-in-law is actually from Baghdad,
mm-hmm.
and so her family's life, obviously, with the current situation, has been destroyed, and some of them are refugees right now in Jordan, and the rest of her family has had to flee to Kurdistan. We have been told that once she is a naturalized citizen, that it should be easier for her to get her family into the United States than it was for us to get her here.
Mm.
Is that true? Is that urban legend?
That's probably true. And the first thing I would suggest you do is talk to an immigration attorney and discuss this. There's a number of possibilities. Nothing is fail-safe. It depends on all kinds of things, including sort of history of the people, including criminal records and all that kind of stuff that we won't talk about on the air. But there's lots of possibilities.
Hmm.
That sounds good. I mean, there have been death threats against her family because she married our son. It's complicated, so we would sure like to get them there. We've actually been lucky enough to meet some of her family in Amman. My husband and I have been there twice in the past 2 years. And, we thank God for our daughter-in-law, and we pray to him every day that we can get the rest of the family out of the mess.
I think there are a number of possibilities. I have to say, nowadays, from what I hear, immigration or, coming as temporary visitors from, that part of the world is more difficult today than it was before September 11th, and given the war, there are a large number of Iraqi refugees, and there's likely to be more as the war continues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a problem for lots of people, and it's not one that our government has fully addressed yet. There have been a number of discussions of what the United States should do when it comes to Iraqi refugees, and I think we'll probably, as a nation, continue to have those discussions.
Well, we're letting in so few, right? That's a big story right now. There are a lot of people whose lives are endangered who want to come here.
Yeah, including friends of the United States and supporters of the United States who are undergoing persecution because of some of that support or neutrality even circumstances. So I think it's a big issue, and we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do and how many and where we're going to relocate some refugees. There's been a big push, and I think it's an issue that's increasingly on our radar screen as a nation. And when it's pretty obvious, but it took us a while to kind of see what was going on. But when you have wars, you have refugees from wars, families. Who are fleeing, people who don't want to participate in the war. People are being persecuted because of their political views in the midst of war. And, there's a big dislocation right now because, the country of Iraq is in a very violent, turbulent war, with the end uncertain, time, and a difficult period for everybody. So I think we're going to have to figure out what to do.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest is Professor Kevin Johnson. He's Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at the University of California Davis School of Law. We're looking at this. It just started yesterday, actually. It's the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services newly designed naturalization test. All of the applicants who file for naturalization from now on will be required to take this redesigned test, and we're looking at what's on the test here, history and government items that are on the test, and I think one of you wants to take part of it, which is great, so we'll do that in a little while. And welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send us an email, it's talk, T-A-L-K. You know how to spell that. Why do I say that? Talk at WPR.org. If you don't know how to spell talk, you wouldn't be listening to us, right? I don't know. You'd be in school. All right. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is the number. Len from Madison is next. Hi, Len.
Hi. Yeah, I was born a citizen. My father and mother both came from the old country, but I was born here. I'm a citizen. In high school, I took civics, and a friend of ours from Germany came over, and he got naturalized, and he gave us a little booklet that he had to learn. I said, "Did you have to learn all this stuff in this book?" And he said, "Oh, no, no, they just asked me a few questions." I looked at the book. I thought, gee whiz, here I took civics in high school. I couldn't answer all those questions. And here my wife came over. She'd been over, and she looked at the book. She said, I'm here now. I'm not going to take that test. I said, "Well, you got to be, you want to come a naturalized citizen?" "Well, we'll see what happens."
Huh.
And it's been, you know, it's been 40 years. And she's still not naturalized.
Huh.
And I thought to myself, well, what the heck? If some people live here that long, they can automatically become a citizen.
Professor Johnson, what are the rules there?
Well, there are some exceptions for people who have been living in the United States who are elderly, aren't required to take some of, or aren't required to face the English language and some of the other parts of the test. So there are exceptions to that. One of the issues that we see out in California is sort of long-term permanent residents, people here legally who are not going anywhere else, and they're fearful of naturalizing for all kinds of reasons. One, I'm afraid of the English part of the test, mm. or I'm afraid of taking this test. I mean, there is a booklet that is on the Citizenship and Immigration Services website that sort of lays out everything, but it requires some time, and for older folks, the idea of that time commitment to learn that is unappealing. So, mm-hmm. but there are exceptions to that. But the problem in California we see is that some people who've been here for an awful long time can get into a little bit of trouble with the law and end up facing deportation.
Oh, yeah.
The deportation laws are very strict now. Suppose you have a firearm conviction. Maybe you forgot your rifle in your truck when you went hunting, and you ended up getting a misdemeanor conviction. And under the immigration laws, basically any firearms conviction can set you up for deportation. Some kinds of driving under the influence convictions can subject you to deportation. So we've been, we have an immigration clinic at the law school, and one of the things the clinics try to do is try to demystify the naturalization test, because, you know, we all assume nobody's ever going to have any problems, but if you've been here a long time, you have citizen children, it's unlikely you're ever going to go home. Hmm. It's certainly a lot safer to naturalize and become a citizen, so that you never risk deportation for mm-hmm. whatever you do. One of the things that one of my colleagues, Bill Hing, he tells this story. It's kind of a funny story. When Winona Ryder a few years ago got arrested and convicted for shoplifting on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, she's lucky she was a citizen, because if she were an immigrant even if she was here lawfully, she would have been immediately jailed and detained as an aggravated felon, because that's how it's classified in the immigration laws, and subject to deportation with very limited judicial review. So it's a risk you take if you're you don't naturalize and become a citizen, especially if you've been here for an awful long time and it becomes increasingly unrealistic you're going to return to your native country.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for the call. Tom is next from Eau Claire. Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. Are you there? No. Let's go to another Tom from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great program. I'm a lawyer, and in a recent position, I had the occasion to really look at what the state of knowledge was, generally speaking, in this country regarding Constitution, civics, you know, the relationship between the two. And it was horrifying to look at the research, although it did kind of confirm what I had thought going in. More people can name the characters on The Simpsons than can name you any of the protections in the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I would guarantee you, and I would bet big money, that not even 40% of citizens could tell you what the first three words of the Constitution are.
Really?
Absolutely. Hmm. Given the research that I did, and I, you know, it just and if you take what the professor said and one of the teachers who called, the idea that you can't come up with a textbook that is suitable to the purpose at this point tells us that the school boards and the school system itself is failing in that regard, and that really we need a massive effort that goes well beyond the people we're admitting. I would say that the people who take the test are probably way ahead of most of the citizenry in understanding what our constitutional form of government means and how it operates.
And caring about it, perhaps, as well, right?
And caring about it, I think, yes. But, you know, you were talking about habeas corpus before, for example. Think about the importance of that issue, despite the complexity, in simply voting in 2008 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I would bet that 20% of the people couldn't tell you what habeas corpus even means, much less how it operates.
Yeah, glad you called, Tom. Thank you. Professor Johnson.
Well, I think that Tom makes some good points. It is disappointing, and I did do my informal test last night of my wife on some of these. Born and bred U.S. citizen, and she knew some of the answers, but not all of the answers. And I think that there's a lot of citizens who are in that group. I can't tell you how many times when I've been at dinner parties with educated people who were asking me who was on the Supreme Court.
Oh, my gosh.
And being amazed that I could name all nine. so I think that it's unfortunate, but there's a sort of dearth of knowledge among some, at least, about some basics about how our government works. I mean, ironically, there's been a greater attention to law and the rule of law and how our Constitution works under the Bush administration, because there are so many claims of these violating the Constitution when it comes to things like habeas corpus and jailing enemy combatants and things like that. So I think that, you know, we are perhaps unfortunately learning some lessons of the Constitution and how it works and doesn't work in some circumstances. But for the most part, I think there is some basic lack of knowledge that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Thanks. Tom is back from Eau Claire. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to hear you. I'm normally at work during this time, but I happen to be on my way to the airport, and you intrigued me with your offer to read me some questions off the exam.
Do you want to pick a certain category, or do you want one question from each of the categories?
Yeah, maybe a sample.
All right.
I'm kind of curious to see, you know, kind of across the board.
All right, we'll give you a sample. Ooh, this will be fun.
Okay.
So this one's American government. Here's a question for you. What is one right or freedom from the First Amendment?
What is one right or freedom from the First Amendment? Well, the freedom of speech,
I suppose.
All right.
You got it. You're good on that. System of government, we go next. What stops one branch of government from becoming too powerful, Tom?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of the simple answer. I suppose it would be the system of checks and balances.
Excellent.
The Constitution.
Excellent.
You do well on this test, I think.
Yeah,
Tom.
So Tom's doing all right. Well, let's give him another one in this category. If both the president and the vice president can no longer serve, who becomes president?
Oh, Jiminy Christmas. Let me think. Would it be the president pro tem of the Senate?
No.
No. Speaker of the House.
There. What'd you say?
Speaker of the House.
There you go. Yeah.
Oh,
just
okay,
that
right.
Was just a little bit of work on your part. Rights and responsibilities section here. What are two rights only for United States citizens?
Excuse me?
They say that's a difficult one. What are two rights only for United States citizens?
Okay. So people who are in the country who aren't citizens cannot do these things.
Right.
Well, let's see. One would be the right to vote.
Yep.
And let's see, what would be the other one? Maybe the right to pay taxes?
Yeah.
No. The federal government takes money from anybody.
Yeah, exactly. The others are apply for a federal job, run for office, and carry a U.S. passport. Those are interesting. We're out of time. Thank you, Tom, very much. Have a good flight. And thank you so much, Professor Johnson. It was a great hour. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Professor Kevin Johnson, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicana Studies at the University of California Davis School of Law. That's interesting, huh? And if you want to take the test, go to uscis.gov. It might be a fun thing to do around the dinner table tonight. Thanks, Rhonda Fanning and John Treader. This is the Ideas Network.